Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about experience, really our experience, leadership experience. What do we need? What kind of experience we need? And how should we get it? Because we're a very practical show, and it's, well, I like theory as well as the next person, but I really like to know how to do things, and I'd like to hear other people's experiences and how to do things so that I can learn and we can learn together. Yes. And of course, oh, thank you. A lot of you, thank you all for being here. A lot of you are already answering the first question that, of course, we're going to ask, because this is an unscripted show, and it goes where we take it, where we'd like to know things. And yes, I am. I'm going to ask one of our general questions and then decide what we'd like to talk about. And I'm going to say, what types of experience do we, as leaders, need? And I see a lot of you have already started to answer, because you knew I was going to ask that now, didn't you? Mm-hmm. You know what? I think that the first topic we're going to talk about from the answers and what you guys are telling me is that we need experience dealing with people. Yeah, we could use a little experience dealing with people. And I think as part of that, a lot of you are using the word empathy. And as part of the experience of dealing with people, yes, we could use some empathy. We could need some understanding of what we're doing and of our people. Mm-hmm. Next up, I think, is going to be we need to have some experience dealing with the culture. And we're going to talk about types of culture, because there are lots, and we want to know what it is that we're doing and what we should look for. So experience dealing with the culture. Mm-hmm. People are talking about, a lot of you are talking about biases and things like that. I'm going to say experience dealing with preconceived notions, right? Yeah, what people come in with, what, in all truth and honesty, maybe we come in with as a preconceived notion. Yeah, so experience dealing with preconceived notions. Mm-hmm. Let's make the last one in this topic experience with conscious modeling of good behavior, right? That we need to be a good example to our participants and to everyone else of what it is that we expect. Because we cannot force people to act in a civil manner, for example, if we are uncivil, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about all of that and the experience that we need. Now let's think about how we need to gain this experience. How are we going to get this experience so that we can use it? Because that's a very important part too. How do we gain experience? How do we find out what to do? How do we gain it? Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. A lot of people are talking about what I'm going to call volunteering. That you put yourself out in the community and you don't necessarily get money. In fact, you usually don't if you're a volunteer. To volunteer, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to call following somebody around and seeing what they do and helping. That's more than volunteer. It's kind of like being an apprentice, because they are teaching you the skills that you need. And you are learning the skills through observation. So that's like being an apprentice, I think. Mm-hmm. How do we gain experience? Pop up by watching our reputation in the community, right? Really paying attention to it, really thinking about it, really understanding that people talk and we'd like them to say something nice. Yeah. So a reputation in the community. And then I think we're going to talk about going outside our comfort zone. Now, comfort zone is a little bit of an Americanism. I am aware of that. But it really means doing something that you wouldn't usually do. I like to do that, personally speaking, because if you get a reputation in the community, that you have lots of people come to you for a specific thing that you have the reputation that you're good at, right? And I like to go outside my comfort zone and learn new things, new ways of doing things, so that I'm not always doing the same thing. Yeah, I think it's terribly interesting. I like to know stuff. I like to know about people. I like to know about issues. I like to know about everything. And so I actually like to go outside my comfort zone and learn things. Yeah, it's fabulous. Mm-hmm. So let's start. How about dealing with people, which I'm going to include empathy in, because that's what really gives us our ability to deal with people. Yeah. Muhammad says you need to understand people's motivations, and this is true. You have to understand their motivations. You have to understand people's motivations, and that's where empathy comes in. Remember that empathy is not necessarily agreement. Empathy is understanding. Empathy is not necessarily agreement. Empathy is understanding. I may not agree with you, but I understand why you hold that idea. I understand what motivates you, right? Now, how are we going to get this empathy, this understanding, not necessarily agreement? Yes, thank you. Lots and lots of people. It's so gratifying that you guys have been listening. Thank you. Lots of folks are saying we're going to employ the 5W questions. Yes, please, because they will allow us to know things. The 5W questions are who, what, where, when, and why. Who, what, where, when, and why. Because they'll let us understand the underlying motivation. Who told you that? For example, who told you that? What did they say? Where did you hear it? When was it told to you? When did you know it? Mm-hmm. And why do you think that? Now, are these questions all asked in this order? Not necessarily. Are these questions all asked at the same time? Probably not. It's a progression. I mean, it might be. Are they asked in front of everybody? I don't know. That's a judgment call for you, depending on the situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pardon me. I took a sip of water. What I do, it shows it's a live show. What I do know is that if you ask these open-ended W questions, you will get responses that will tell you stuff that you need to know. Why somebody is insisting on that, for example, even though it doesn't seem like they should be, right? Yeah. Why it is that who told it to them, right? You know, Recipe for Peace Now, we talk a lot about the invisible participants. And the invisible participants are really the ones that are impactful on these 5W questions, especially the who. Who told you that, right? And they're the people, the organization, the whatever, the family, that your participants kind of report back to. Now, when I say report back to, I don't mean like in writing formally necessarily, but I do mean that their opinion counts greatly with your participant. They really, really, really value their opinion, and they really, really, really want them to approve, which means that you've got people influencing the people in the room. Well, let's think about them. They are important, and we need to know that they are an important part of the puzzle, an important part of the negotiation. I actually try to invite them into the process. I think they should come. I think they should be a part of it, even if they can come on Skype. Doesn't have to actually physically be there, right? I would like to talk to them. I would like to listen to them. I would like to have their input because it's important. Mm-hmm. And this is where if you promise to keep someone anonymous, you must keep your promises. That is part of your reputation. And if you make your reputation not to be good, as in you're not dependable and not telling, if someone gives you their opinion, their time, their effort, and they do not wish to be quoted in any way or known, sometimes this is very important. Because if people are asking why. Well, first of all, the why about keeping a confidence is because you gave your word. And word will get out that your reputation is no good. And if you give your word and say, no, I won't tell anybody who you are, and then you tell, no one will ever trust you again. And someone else in the community will be the go-to person because you will no longer be the preferred expert. Because people understand that that really is not a good thing, right? Even if they're not directly impacted, it's like, wow, you promised and then you told. What else do you not keep your word on, right? What else do you lie about? Yeah, very important to protect your reputation. The reason, and people asking how come, would it be like criminal or something? No, because we don't keep secrets of a criminal nature, of course. But sometimes something is controversial. The issues are controversial. What you're trying to do is controversial. And somebody who has a real good opinion and would be an excellent expert and is really in the community might not want their name to be known. Pardon me. Oh, for heaven's sake. Sorry about that. I sneezed on you guys. Oh, thank you. A lot of people are going, bless you. Thank you. It's very nice of you. Thank you for the blessing. A lot of people, and they're not sure if you're going to win or not, and this is just a practicality. Oh. Excuse me. I'm going to do something you should never do on live blog radio and like that. I'm actually going to blow my nose. Excuse me. You can't pause this and like that, so it's kind of like, oh, I'll be taking a short break now. Oh my, hello, and how are all of you? No, I think it's allergy season. People are asking if I'm sick, which is a very nice thing to ask. No, I'm glad you worry, but no, I think it's just allergy season. But my goodness, I'm sorry about that. That was kind of impolite, but I couldn't help it. People don't want to be known. They want to be anonymous, but they're nice enough to give their expertise, their advice. Sometimes even they're backing, as in, I know somebody who you could talk to, and they would be helpful, right? But they're not sure that your side's going to win, and they have something to lose, a job, a reputation, a position, something in some way that they don't want it to be known that at perhaps an early stage, which you might be in, that they kind of backed you just in case it doesn't work out. That's very human, and it's very reasonable. And you must respect that. Yeah. I've had, for example, leaders help, leaders give an opinion, leaders say which direction they think this should go. But they don't want anyone to know because it's impactful and we're not sure how it's going to end up. Our crystal balls don't work. Yeah. So sometimes somebody needs to be anonymous, but it's a personal choice. And it is something that is not illegal or anything. It's just, it's sensible. It's oftentimes a personal economic choice. Yes, a lot of times you have very different people in the room. And they might represent different interests. And their interests are the invisible participants. Because they want to be sure that they get they get properly heard, right? Oh, sorry about that. And the, for example, you have different types of interests in the room, but they want the same outcome, ultimately, which is why they're there. They're all fighting for the same thing, but you have to remind them that they're really all in this together because we all want something to occur. Yeah, and it's very important. We all want it. For example, in the United States, marijuana is federally illegal, right? And different groups worked for many years to try to legalize it federally. You've probably seen this in the news. Our attorney general is kind of on the warpath about this because it was never made legal federally. We had a quite liberal administration at the time, and the president of the United States and the attorney general, who is the highest law enforcement official in the land, right? The attorney general is like the head of law enforcement. Well, I know it's a simplification, but for this purpose, it's sufficient. And they decided not to enforce the federal laws on marijuana. Did that make it legal? No. But the states, because they could see that they were getting nowhere after years and years of fighting with the federal government of negotiation, the states started to do something extremely weird, which caused the federal government to react with a, we're not going to prosecute, right, but not legality. The states decided to put it to, some of them, decided to put it to the voters whether or not marijuana should be legal in the state. Very, very weird concept, right? Because, well, gee, you've got a federal law which trumps state law, but we're going to try it. A lot of people had to be in the room to reach that conclusion, to put it on the ballot, to do all the things that needed to be done, the advertising, the public opinion polls, the whole bit, right? And they had very diverse interests, but one goal, legalization, even if it's state legalization, so that we could come out of the shadows, right? You had growers, people who wanted to grow it. You had merchandisers. People want to sell it. You had a whole bunch of different kinds of illnesses that would benefit from having marijuana be able to be used medicinally, medical marijuana. All kinds of different organizations that each had their own leaders, too. And nobody wanted to give up their position, their leadership. But they all wanted it would enhance them to have medical marijuana legalized, right? Different kinds, HIV, glaucoma, symptoms of terrible diseases that cause wasting and stuff, muscle-type diseases. Elderly people, because it alleviates a lot of problems and like that. So you had a real diverse group. And you had all the invisible participants from their groups in the room, because they also were interested. And they reported back to their groups, a lot of them, as in they wrote newsletters and things about how's it going. You see how many people that is in the room, how many diverse interests, how many leaders who want to remain leaders of their group and don't want to somehow get folded into another group? Yeah. So we needed to think about it, and we needed to remember, all of us, those in the room, those who were the invisible participants, to have understanding of each other, because we all had a common goal. And that's a good experience to have, because it reminds you that, yeah, we're not the same at all, but we want the same thing. Well, that gives us a great interest in dealing with each other successfully. This is a good point that Elizabeth and as others are making, that it's always a different issues, even if it's the same people. Yeah, you can have experience with this exact group. In fact, sometimes we do, sometimes I do at least, because I deal with organizations. I deal with corporations and things. And sometimes it's the exact same people in the room. But it's still different because we're people and things, you know, we don't all do the same things all the time. And because we have different issues. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, took a sip of water. Our next topic, oops, we better mosey on along or we're going to run out of time. Our next topic is dealing with culture. Yes, Hussein says that oftentimes religious custom is a taught preconceived notion, right? I'm going to get to preconceived notions next time, in our next topic. But yeah, we have religious and ethnic cultures that underlie things and sometimes really do impact the issues depending on what's going on. And you need to understand that. That's part of the empathy, that we understand that this is, well, that this is a religious truth. And faith is like that. You have it's faith. You have ideas that have been handed down about how things should be, right? And you need to work the issues, work the negotiations into those parameters. It's not that difficult if you really think about it, because really all of these parameters are moral guidelines more than anything else, right? And we're doing something that is very moral and very good idea, right? Because we're trying to resolve something. So we fit within those guidelines. Let's make a conscious effort to fit in the guidelines so that we're happy, so that everybody understands that they are being heard, that it's a good thing, right? Yeah. And then you've got another kind of culture oftentimes. I see it a lot because I do a lot of multinationals. You've got a corporate culture or an organizational culture. It might not be a corporate, but organizational. A way we've always done it in this, in this group, in this company, in this room, right? Yeah, in this church, mosque, synagogue, whatever. This is the way it's always been done. And we kind of like it. We're going to talk about comfort zone later on in this program. If you ask people to think about their culture and really do something that's not against their culture, but is a little bit different than what they've done before, that makes people nervous. And then they wonder about how their boss will feel about it. Boss being, I don't know, it could be God. It could be your religious leader. It could be your office boss. They worry about the leadership, the boss, the person above them, right? And how they're going to react to it because, well, this is not the way we usually do things, right? And that's a little scary. This is not the way we usually do things. This is not how things are done. Right? And that is scary. And it is something that you need to accommodate and understand. It's scary. Yeah. And you need to really think about it. Right? Yeah. And think about how we're going to make, well, maybe we need to make an exception for these issues with these people at this time, so we can have a good working relationship. Hey, you know that's perfectly valid? To do it now, this time, because we need to, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good point, too. People are talking about leadership style. Ezra and others are talking about modifying leadership style. Sometimes that'll work. Sometimes you need to. Two, all of us has a leadership style that suits us, and we prefer it. It's the way we interact. It's the way we deal with other people. And so we're pleased with it. It works for us. But sometimes, especially in corporate culture or in a culture that is different than our own, all right, in the United States, Americans tend to think we should talk about everything a lot. We're into democratic rule, right? And we want to get our full negotiation money. We want to argue. We want to hear everybody's side. We want to reach consensus. And it takes a while. It's kind of messy. It works, but it takes a while. Let's admit this, right? In some cultures, they really don't want to do that. I mean, they want to have some discussion. They want to understand the facts. They want to understand what's going on. But they really would like more leadership in the sense of, okay, we've determined what the facts are. This is what we're going to do type leadership, right? And sometimes you must modify for that and understand it, that this is a moment of, well, this is how we're going to do it. This is what will occur. This is what we're going to decide. And then we can always modify it, and if it doesn't work, we can go back. But they want the leader to really tell them what to do. This is true in some actual social cultures, religious cultures. It is also true in some corporate cultures. You're brought in to really lead and to make the decision and say, okay, I'm the expert. This is how we're going to do it. Follow my lead. I will assign you projects. I will assign you things to do. You will do them because that's what we're doing. This is what I think should be done. And so that's a modification of leadership style, right? And you have to feel that. You have to be aware of it, that sometimes groups really need you to modify and to really tell them what to do so they can do it and really, really take charge more so than sometimes. Does that make sense? Yes. This is a good point, too, that Thomas and others are making, that when you have a culture, corporate, ethnic, religious, whatever it is, that there, instead of having individual experiences that are neutral, people accept, Thomas says, they accept as truth and fact, although it's really opinion and tradition. There's an acceptance of something as truth or fact, although it's really an opinion or a tradition. It's so ingrained that it seems like a fact. And it is that fact is the basis for what they think, for their logic, right? But it's not exactly a fact. It's really a tradition or an opinion. But they've known it so long that they consider it to be an actual fact or a truth. Well, let's think about that. Let's think about what others in the group think. Let's think about doing some research maybe in this day of the internet, right? And see what others have done. See what others think about that. See the interpretation maybe, right? Yeah, it's very important because you need to understand that that's understood as a fact, even though you don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. Let me take another sip of water. Oh, my goodness, my straw drowned. It's not a bad sign. Excuse me, my voice seems to be going in and out slightly. Which leads us to our next topic, which is experience with preconceived notions. Because that's kind of what those are. their preconceived notions about how the world works. What is truth? What is just known? Ever have anybody yell that everybody knows that? Fill in the blank. Everybody knows that. Well, kind of they don't. Because that's a preconceived notion. And there's a difference between preconceived notions that are learned, that's a fact, and come from experience. I've dealt with these people before, and I have an opinion about them. I have an opinion about their abilities, their truthfulness, you name it. But it's kind of a personal opinion. But it is indeed being brought into the room. Mm-hmm. This is a true statement. Suki says we need to watch for our own preconceived notions. Do we have some that's causing us to react a certain way? How about our preconceived notions? What we think, right? Yeah. We need to be aware of them. We need to be aware of the fact that they are impactful, that they are important, but they give us a certain bent, a certain preconceived idea of what is going to occur and what should occur, which is perhaps even more important, right? So we have some preconceptions of our own, and we have to be aware of them. We have to be aware of them so that we can, guard against if necessary. Mm-hmm. Yes. People are asking, if the preconceived notions that have been accepted as truth because they are learned, they're taught by someone that you respect, an elder, a culture, a organization, whatever, which is harder to deal with, the preconceptions that are learned or the preconceptions that are experienced? I'm going to say it depends, because it depends on the situation and what we're dealing with. Oftentimes, a learned preconception is very close to faith, and that's pretty deeply felt. An experienced one, though, makes people stubborn because they know that this is how it's going to turn out. They just know it, right? Both of them have their own charming problems. I think it depends on the situation and depends on what's being discussed, really, more than anything else. Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know. It depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they both need to be understood, which is why we ask the 5W questions. Any kind of a preconception will come out during that. And then we will know what we're dealing with. Yeah, which is really two-thirds of the battle, is knowing how people are perceiving what's going on and what their expectation is for resolution. Mm-hmm. Yes. This is a good point, too. Erin says that you do not necessarily need to eliminate the preconceived notions. You just need a working relationship now and in the future. Yes, thank you. It is not our job to try to get people to no longer have their preconceived notions. We'll go insane. That's not our purpose. Our purpose, as Erin says, is to get a working relationship now and usually in the future, too. Because if we get a working relationship and we find out that for this time, for these issues and this person, who is obviously an exception to my preconceived notions, right? This person I can deal with and we're going to reach a successful outcome. And then the next time these types of issues come up and somebody needs to deal with somebody that they, oh my God, I don't think I can deal with them, that kind of somebody. The next time that happens, we're going to be okay. We're going to be able to call the person we worked with before and say, well, you know, let's work together on this again and see how it shakes out. See how it is going to affect us, right? Yeah. So it's a working relationship now, and then the memory of the working relationship for the future, that even though I probably still have my ideas about, I don't know this person's group, I can work with this person because we've done it successfully before. Mm-hmm. Which leads us to modeling appropriate behavior. We need to experience that, not only experience it, we need to do it, right? Because the civility rules are the thing that we model the most as appropriate behavior, and they are extremely important to all negotiation. Yes, the civility rules, for those of you who are new, and really for those of us who think about them all the time, so they permeate everything. Their very base, the civility rules say, we will not be rude to each other. We will not be rude to each other. Mm-hmm. We will not take someone else's turn, for example. We won't butt in. We will not roll our eyes, cross our arms, sigh. Pass notes, which nowadays is passing texts, of course, and like that. Mm-mm. We're going to be courteous to each other. We, as leader, will have a better experience, and so will our participants, if the civility rules are enforced. Well, you have to tell everybody about the civility rules, right? That's transparency. When you get the, when you convene the group, that's one of the things you tell them about, the civility rules. And everybody goes, yeah, yeah, but you'd be surprised. You're going to need to pull them out in a lot of the times. So the civility rules need to be modeled by us. We must never be rude to anyone, lose our temper, raise our voice, use a bad word. Whenever it is, we're going to be the model of civility, because we cannot ask people to act in a civil manner if we do not. Can't ask them to do something that you're not doing, that you're not modeling. The civility rules need to be announced, even in groups that you don't think you're going to need it. And they need to be enforced if someone starts to have an infraction, right? Immediately, consistently, and fairly. Immediately, consistently, and fairly. You do not let things slide until things get bad and you've got a bad atmosphere and not a convivial one, right? And then go, oh yeah, we're going to enforce the civility rules. No, you are proactive. You enforce them whenever you see that there may be a breach, right? Mm-hmm. Immediately, consistently, and fairly. Consistently being every single time, even though you've said it a kajillion times. Just think of them as two-year-olds, and you have to keep saying it. Yes. Mm-hmm. If you have if you're modeling appropriate behavior, and everybody's having civility rules, we're all being civil to each other. Yes, it creates a convivial atmosphere. Good point. Elizabeth says it also creates enthusiastic teams because everyone is treated with respect. Yes, you've got a convivial atmosphere. Everybody likes coming. Hey, there's food, but it's not a chore to be in this group, and you've got enthusiasm because everybody is treated with respect. And that's really what the civility rules do. You are correct. They treat your fellow participant and the leader with respect. Yes. Everyone's voice is heard. Everyone's opinions are heard. And then we go towards the middle. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, if everyone has really been able to be in the discussion and everything, we all understand that there's some negotiation, some compromise that goes on. That's not a problem. Yeah. Yes, disability was made for a better experience, is what quite a few people are saying, Thomas and others. Yes, this is true. Margaret and others are asking how. The answer is that we model as good behavior, right? And then we have the right as leader and a model of good behavior to expect that our participants will follow suit, that they will also act in a manner of civility and good behavior to their fellow participants. Yes. So, before we run out of time, we've talked about the types of experience we need. Now let's talk about how to gain that experience. Because it's nice to talk about it, but we need to know how to acquire some. Because experience is something that you need to acquire, that you need to look for, that you need to really search out, right? So how should we gain experience? Yes, I think volunteer is going to be our first one. This is a very good point that Lee is making, that when you volunteer, it gives service to the community, which is a mighty fine thing, and the community knowledge of your experience and expertise. Yes. You're giving service to the community that you want people to basically hire you in. Or maybe not, but it is well known that you did this and it worked out extremely well. Excuse me. Which will give you reputation in the community, right? You have reputation in the community. Well, gee, Willikers, there we go. We know, people know that we're good at it, right? Yeah, not only have we gained experience through volunteering, but we've gained, well, people who might be clients or recommend us, for example, right? Nothing wrong with that. But you should always go in with the idea that you're going to volunteer and help and not the idea that you're going to gain something from it, because then you won't have a disappointment if it's not a real business opportunity. Because a lot of times it's not. It's just you go in because you want to be of use, you want to be of service, and then anything else that comes from it personally is kind of an extra topping. It's wonderful. People are talking about volunteering as part of a group. Yeah, why not? A lot of times service organizations will come and volunteer as a group, and they will kind of, the group participants, they kind of bond and like that, and they are, and it's a good experience all the way around. You gain experience, you gain maybe new friends, right, and you get to help somebody. Yes, I actually belong to what is called a service organization. I actually belong to Rotary, yes, and their motto is service above self. And we actually go as teams and do good works for the community, for the world, right? And volunteering with that, twofold, is lots of fun because you're with your fellow people and it's interesting, yeah? And you get to connect and network. Pardon me. But also, it's good experience. You've learned something. You've learned how to do something. You've learned to negotiate something, probably, because a lot of these things need government negotiation to allow us to come in and do something nice, because governments are not necessarily all that interested in their people. Now, are they? Yes. Yes, this is kind of an American thing, I think. But then again, I'm not familiar with anybody else's tax system. Georgia and others are talking about donating your salary back to the organization, which is kind of volunteer. You get paid, but you donate, but you don't take the money, which is a donation back to the organization, right? You just don't take the check, you sign it back over. In the United States, that has tax repercussions because it allows you to make a charitable deduction, but you will have to pay taxes on your income. So it kind of washes both ways. But it's an idea to give back, to give. It's like tithing, yeah, to give back even a certain percentage. Yes. Good point too, actually. Yeah. Helen says it's also a good example to participants and their families that you're volunteering and to your own family and everything and to your groups. It's a good example to everyone that you would volunteer your time and effort. And then that will cause them to follow suit and to have a higher regard for your reputation, right? Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually quite good to be willing to volunteer and to be a good example to the community that you would do such a thing. Yeah, it's a good idea. Let's go on to the next one, which is to kind of be an apprentice. I don't like to say intern because intern has a specific connotation of someone being in college or graduate school and volunteering to be an intern to get credit, right? Mostly college credit. Yeah, we have interns. Recipe for Peace Now has interns. But it's interesting to be an apprentice, be an intern. Because you learn stuff and you're on the inside and you see how the negotiation is really done and you see the prep work that goes into it. Because, quite frankly, those of us who are good at this do not just show up. We've done a lot of prep work. We've read everything that's been presented. We've done some research. We've really thought about it. We might even have connected with an expert so that we ask questions in advance until we have an idea about the path, right? And yeah, all these things are very important. And if you see it from the inside, especially if you're inexperienced, you will learn stuff. Yeah. You will know things. You will become, well, dare I say it, an expert because you'll know how it's done, how it works. Very important. This is a good point, too, and possibly even easier to get. I mean, you'd have to have someone's permission to shadow them, to be an apprentice, to be an intern. Even if you're very good and you're very talented, well, sometimes not everybody wants you underfoot. And you have to remember that that's what you kind of are, because you're not adding that much to the group. You're mainly there for your own learning, right? And training. This is a very good point too that Helen and others are making, that you could also, in order to get some experience, you could also be a participant and explore that angle. And think about people's technique and think about what's going on. It's actually very interesting to be a participant, even after you've been in business for a while and you're really good at negotiation and mediation. It's very interesting to be a participant because it shows you a different angle. It shows you a slightly different angle about what it is and about how people react to the leader and what they think of that leadership style. See, as a participant, you're privy to that. People talk to you because you're them, right? Yeah. People want to, you're one of us. You're a participant. And you can think about it from both sides and learn immeasurably. Oftentimes, you learn something good and useful, right? Sometimes you learn something not so useful or something critical, right? That's good and useful too, because you'll know not to do that. And you think about, oh, I do that. Oops. Right? Yeah. How to gain experience? Let's get a reputation in the community. Yeah, we want one. We want a good reputation in the community so that we're the go-to person, so that we're who you want to deal with, so that we are really useful. And people go, oh, that's Sue. Yeah, I see that sometimes. Isn't that the funniest thing? Because I know people are doing it. You can see them out of the corner of your eye. They kind of nod or point over in your direction, and people, somebody says, who's that? And then somebody says, oh, that's Sue. Oh, I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't ever know if I should run. But it seems to be a good reputation thing. Oh, that's Sue. Yeah. Yes. People are talking about peer pressure, that you have a reputation in the community, and when your expertise comes up, if somebody else is in charge, then there's some peer pressure to bring you in too, because people know that you can really do it, really handle it, really know what you're doing, and they're not so big on the person that's been brought in and is now in charge, oftentimes with good reason. Because there's been some sort of political act, but they need somebody who knows what they're doing. Pardon me. Sometimes there's a certain amount of nepotism in organizations. Mm-hmm. Or somebody who is quite rightfully the leader, the boss, but they haven't exactly kept up with the times. And they're kind of doing something that's not real valid nowadays, right? And so you need to bring in somebody with a reputation that they know what they're doing. Somebody who is an expert. Sometimes I'll bring in an expert in those instances. Because they don't want to hear it. They don't want to change. Change is hard. It is. If you wanted it, you would have done it already. Change is hard. And you have to remember that. People are not just being stubborn or something. It's hard to change. It's complicated. It's, well, yeah, we don't really want to. And so you need to have, change needs to be brought in maybe gradually, right? Mm-hmm. And that may be your reputation to be able to effectuate that. Mm-hmm. But you need to, but sometimes there's some peer pressure to bring you in. Because people go, you know, we really need Sue to come in and straighten this out. You can stay. We'll bring her in as an expert, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of folk are talking about using the media to enhance your reputation as an expert. Well, you know, if nobody knows that you're really good at this, then how are you going to have a reputation? So, yeah, the media is a wonderful thing because it will show people who to go to, right? Yeah, it'll show who's the expert, show who's the best. We've all done that. Not so much for negotiation maybe, but in our personal lives. I needed a dentist, well, I needed an oral surgeon in all truth and honesty. And I put it out on my friends in Facebook who knows a good oral surgeon. And I chose the one, the doctor, who more than one person recommended highly. We did it kind of by democracy, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And so I asked and people responded. And, yes, he was excellent. But what I really wanted to know was their reputation. Anybody have a really good reputation, a good experience with somebody that you could pass on to me so I could have a good experience too? Yeah, that was their reputation. And, yes, we do it all the time. And we use social media to ask about reputation all the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you need to have your reputation be thought about by those who need to think it and not be kind of a secret. Mm-hmm. The last thing we're going to talk about is comfort zone. Oops, I think we may run out of time for the recipes. But we're having such a good conversation. Yes, I keep forgetting to do it during the middle of the show. Prior shows are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com, because we do talk about these principles quite extensively. Mm-hmm. So, we've gotten some experience. we want more experience, and we've gotten kind of in a rut, right? We have a reputation for a certain type of negotiation, which is fabulous because it means that it's a successful reputation. But it also means that we are seeing an awful lot of the same thing, right? Yeah. And we'd like to branch out. We'd like to know new things, if nothing else, right? Yeah. We'd like to have understanding. Mm-hmm. So what should we do? Well, let's go outside our comfort zone. Our comfort zone is that which we all always do and we're really, really comfortable with. We've got this. We're good at it. But let's expand, especially now that there's so much technology and new things. You need to always understand that your comfort zone needs expanding on a regular basis. Because if you don't, well, you're not going to get anywhere. You want to have your comfort zone be pretty broad, really. Be capable of being expanded. Be capable of saying, look, this is what I need in order to up my experience, right? Yeah. People are saying to travel outside to learn. Yeah. Travel outside to learn. Let's learn something new. Let's find out how others are handling this, right? Yes. Yes, this is a very good point, too. Michelle and others are saying you also need to bring in experts. I don't know what this is. I've never experienced this before. Let's bring in an expert who knows something to give us some guidance, right? Hey, nothing wrong with that. I'm very big on bringing in experts. I think it's important. I think it's important to really stretch your comfort zone, to really think outside the box, to really say, you know, this is maybe how it's always been done, but let's think about this new way. Let's think about that. Let's wonder if maybe this is a way to do it too, right? Yeah, our comfort zone. And learning from the experts, too. Yeah, the key to all of this is being willing to learn. Quite a few people are talking about willingness to go outside your comfort zone. If you're going to take your participants outside their comfort zone, you have to give them fair warning. Really? Yeah, you have to ease them into it, and understand that that's what's happening, that we are going beyond our comfort zone as a team, really. We are going to be capable of doing so much more than we think we are. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go beyond our comfort zone, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And be willing to learn. My friends, one of the things we are not going to learn today is a new recipe, and I apologize, because we are out of time. Yes. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. If you want to find us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Prior shows, they are archived on that website. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.